You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Living on Gumbunya country in Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sandy. Hello, and welcome back to Talk the Walk. Anne Carrick is my guest today, a social worker with over 25 years' experience in a diverse and interesting range of contexts. Anne's most recent adventure was a three-year stint in a remote Aboriginal community on Arnhem Land coast, off the beautiful Arafura Sea. Anne was very much immersed in community life as a social worker in a social and emotional wellbeing program within the health sector. But Anne started out in Adelaide, as many social workers do in community welfare work, and somehow found her way following the song lines up to Darwin. I look forward to exploring Anne's personal and professional adventures in the world of Indigenous social work. Thanks for joining me on the podcast today, Anne.
You're welcome.
So let's go back to those early days in social work. Prior to and after graduating with your degree, you did quite a large stint with the Department of Family and Community Services, which is now known as the Department of Child Protection in Adelaide. So what was that experience like for you?
It was a good introduction to social work. There was a wide range of experiences. It was good working in different offices. I particularly liked my time out in Ceduna, where I worked for about 6 months.
What was your first role within that department? Because it would have been a huge department, and I'd imagine there would be quite a few different fields of work. Can you give us a bit of an idea of what you were starting out doing?
After I graduated, I actually did a few things before I ended up in the department. I started off in the Adelaide office and very much being like an intake worker, very much focused on usually people were wanting money, financial assistance. Then I moved into crisis care and did a lot of crisis work there.
Let's talk about Ceduna. Was that your first exposure to working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families, or had you had some exposure before that experience?
When I was working with community welfare, a number of our clients would have been Aboriginal people. So moving out to Ceduna, I guess, was an opportunity to work more closely with Aboriginal people.
When you're thinking about that time, the 6 months that you spent in Ceduna, what were some of the biggest learnings for you?
One was that English was not a first language for lots of people. Another was that cultural ways, it was very difficult for older Aboriginal men to be sitting in a room with a young white social worker. There was a death in the police station, a death in custody while I was there in the early days when death in custody was becoming quite concerning. And it was interesting that the manager wanted me to go to this community meeting and somehow tell Aboriginal people how they were to cope with this. And I just couldn't do that. I went to the meeting, I listened, I saw what people were experiencing and feeling, and I thought, as a white person, I don't have a role here. This is an experience that Aboriginal families and communities are coping with, and I couldn't see how this white person could possibly take over and direct them in what they were supposed to do.
Mm. So what did you take away from that experience, being in that room with that those families that were grieving?
It's more than important to actually listen to what people are saying, not to ask questions. Let stories unfold. People will come and go into how they're going to be solving the problem. And it may not just be at that first meeting, because I'm sure lots of meetings happened back in respective communities and homelands that were working out ways how to deal with this. Mm. What I learned was that often there's not a role for a white person. Apart from showing your support and concern, and where possible, opening any gates that are needed so that families or communities can get the services they need.
I sense that there was something really awkward about you being in that room at that time. What are the ethics and values that you brought to that told you, you know, I don't have a place here and I'm just going to sit and listen?
It was sort of early days of social work, so I suppose it was very much around start with where the person or the community is and then build on that. I guess respect where people are at and where they want to go. that people need to decide for themselves, so self-determination. And around two, I think social justice, in that people do have the ability to sort things out.
So jumping forward a few years, in 2013 you upped and moved to Arnhem Land. So that's a pretty big step. Can you walk us through your thinking at this time and what was motivating you?
I had the opportunity to visit a remote community, and often people think places like Tennant Creek or Alice Springs are remote, but this is really remote. It wasn't a town, it was actually a remote community. And while I was there, I was intrigued by the whole situation. Like, how come this is a Western country and people are living in third world conditions? I found that very hard. And it alerted me to social determinants of health and well-being and how disadvantaged a lot of people in particularly Northern Territory are, and I suspect also Northern Queensland and Northern Western Australia. While I was there, the opportunity to work in the health centre came up, and I had to think about it and met with the CEO and decided, yep, I want to do this. So it just unfolded. It wasn't planned. I was going just to have a look at a community because a friend happened to be working there. And then things just unfolded.
Wow. So you mentioned to me prior to this interview that one of the most important things you'd read prior to taking this step was reading Kim Mahood's article called Cartier Are Like Toyotas. When they break down, we get another one. What was it about this reading that prepared you for working in remote Aboriginal Australia?
It described very well what, I'll use the word Ballenders, that article was based in Central Australia, but Ballenders is what I'm used to at the top end. It was very good at illustrating how what Ballenders need to know, some of the history based on colonisation and ongoing racism, but also what happens to Ballenders when they get into a community and some of the pitfalls to look out for. I would recommend anyone who's thinking of working remote to read it.
So you're working in a social and emotional well-being team in this remote Aboriginal community. Can you speak about what a typical day looked like for you?
I could have meetings planned with cultural workers, and we might have identified some families we wanted to visit. But then on the way to the meeting, a client might wave you down and they're going through a crisis at the time and they're needing assistance, particularly if there's been a threat of suicide or if there's been any domestic violence. So that would change how the day was going to unfold.
And how frequent was that, like responding to those kinds of crises? Because they're quite big things, domestic violence and suicide interventions. How frequent was that?
Domestic violence and attempted suicide was very common and is very common in remote communities. And unfortunately, suicide is often seen as a coping mechanism, and there could be a huge range of reasons why people attempt suicide. Often it's a cry for help. Often it's because things aren't going well and they don't know any other way out of it. Domestic violence is a daily occurrence. It would happen, I think, in virtually every home, virtually every day. Mm. Often it's because of alcohol and drugs. Often we don't see it. The community has learnt either how to deal with it themselves, or more tragically, they see domestic violence as just part of life. And they accept it, whereas it's not normal, it wasn't part of culture, it's just become that.
Yeah. So how was that for you, coping with the reality of that kind of life in the community? What effect did that have on you?
It was hard because you knew this was going on and often people wouldn't talk about it. If it was serious and somebody had called the police, then the police would be involved. If somebody was seriously injured, they would be taken to the clinic. So the clinic would tend to deal with the initial needs, and then they would ask the social-emotional wellbeing program if we could provide ongoing support.
So you're kind of there after the initial crisis has sort of happened and there's been a community response. You're there in the aftercare?
It's more that, yes. And that's if the victim or the perpetrator or the family would like involvement. Sometimes because of cultural ways of doing things, it may be that some of the traditional elders or the aunts would do what they would normally do. And so there wasn't a role for us. And quite often I think because the community knows how to deal with situations, they do know what to do. And occasionally it would be useful for social emotion wellbeing program to be involved.
So can you speak about some of the ways elders and the community did respond in those situations? What are the ways that they were problem solving these issues themselves?
That was hard to know because my sense is that while us Ballanders would be exposed to some of the cultural ways, a lot of it they didn't feel we needed to know and they just went about doing what they needed to do. My sense was that in the background there was a band of really strong women who were doing amazing work in supporting their families and the community. Where senior men became involved, my sense it was more around taking perhaps those who'd been violent out bush and getting them to rethink about what they had done. Sometimes they might be banished if there was some cultural or tribal reason for them not to be in the community at that time. Sometimes they would go out themselves because they didn't want the police to come after them, so there would be a bit of peace in that family while their man was out of community. My sense is that us Ballanders see some of what goes on, but there's a whole lot happening at different levels throughout the community that we don't see and we're not privy to.
So can you speak about, I guess, some of the outcomes that you felt you were able to achieve for maybe some of the women that were in domestic violence situations?
One young woman asked for assistance and her request was to be flown out of the community. And fortunately at that time, the local council did have the means to do that. Otherwise, finding someone to fund an airfare was really difficult. So we did speak to her partner and they'd had a big argument. She didn't believe what he told her and her request was she wanted to be out of community. So fortunately we were able to arrange that.
A large part of your work was case management, assessment and responding to crises, as we've talked about. And how do you think the social work assessment process, perhaps in your experience in the top end, might be different to, say, Ceduna or more urban communities?
One of the big differences was that we co-worked with our Aboriginal community workers. We would do joint assessments. We would plan together what was needed. We would work what's called two ways. So our Aboriginal workers would work their way and Ballanders would work their way. And there would be some meeting of similarity, but often it was quite different. And I found initially, like I tended to be the professional, and I learned fairly quickly that you step back, that being the white professional is not what's needed. You let the community workers have the main focus. And over time, I could see that really they were the ones that needed to guide the work. So they would guide how we would do intake and assessment, how we would respond, how we would assist the family. And that even became, towards my last few months that I was there, that often we would go out to work two ways, but they were comfortable enough just to wave me aside and I would have to sit and wait. A lot of it would happen in language. Some of it would be in English. And then I could kind of pick up what was going on and what was needed. And if the decision was made that the woman needed to go to the safe house, then they'd ask me to arrange that. Or if the decision was made for the woman to go to the police to make a statement, then they'd ask me to do that. So usually I became the advocate for using Western systems that would best aid the clients.
Yeah, right. So I imagine the work would look totally different and may not even happen if you didn't have community workers working alongside you. What particular skills or knowledge did you really appreciate about the Aboriginal workers?
They knew the community well. They knew the families well. They knew what families didn't get on with other families. They would know if there was any payback in process. They would know what ongoing tribal issues there were. They would know what, like for us, we might see a woman who had depression, and they would say, no, her family's been cursed way back generations. And the only way that's going to end is when all that family dies out. So we were working with that cultural belief, but also with this woman's, for us, mental health.
Yeah, I imagine that would be hugely challenging. Their interpretations or their understandings of wellness in the mind being linked to cultural reasoning and us having a totally different way of viewing that. That would be really interesting. Something I picked up in your CV when I was reading it through was this concept of worried well. It's a term I've not heard before. Can you explain what the community's understanding of worried well means?
I was fortunate to work in this community when the social emotional wellbeing program was starting, and we had an excellent manager who just saw that that was needed, that the community had far too much emphasis on mental health, diagnosis, going to the clinic, medications, and that the community needed something more positive, recovery focused, strengths based. And so I found that exciting to be in the beginning of that. And although initially we seemed to get clients who did have a mental health diagnosis, we also became aware of people who were just going through life issues. And the clinic and the mental health services wanted to label them, whereas we saw them, they're anxious, they're about to have a baby. They've not done this before. They've got lots of aunts and other people around them. They're anxious about having a baby. They don't have a mental health condition. They don't need medication. So
I really love that concept of worried well, because we all worry and we all have stress in our lives. It's whether that becomes debilitating and makes us dysfunctional, isn't it? So yeah, I really love that concept of being able to live our lives worried well. We're okay. Worrying is normal, and stress is a factor of all our lives, isn't it?
Yes.
So I also noticed that you supervised a couple of social work students on placement, and I was wondering, what was their experience like in the community, and how well prepared do you think they were?
If I was to have a social work student again in a community, I would do it very differently. My sense is that because it was such a remote community, ideally they should come and visit and just see what their reaction was to the community. When employing new staff, often as part of the interview process, like if they passed the formal interview, was they would come out to the community and just see what they thought. And I think that would be a very good idea for students. The other thing I would do is make sure they had a break mid-placement so that they actually got out of the remote community and were able to just cruise around Darwin for a while and then come back. The experience was challenging, and what they hadn't expected was to be able to do a whole range of skills that, why am I doing this? That's not what I was trained to do. But if you're loading up a troopie because you're taking a group of women out to ancestral lands to collect mud crabs, then that's part of what you do. And it's the whole engagement that you can actually use those occasions for just quietly working with someone. Doesn't need to be a formal setting, and you're more likely to be able to work with someone where their attention is on collecting mud mussels rather than, and face to face doesn't work with Aboriginal people. Sitting side by side is better, but being out in the community or sitting on a tree is probably even better still.
So these students weren't quite up to being in that kind of environment?
I think it was so unexpected that that would be part of what their fieldwork would involve. So it's helping them see that joining in with the community is what is valued, rather than being a professional. And I guess you don't expect to go out on some field work when you've got all these 4 years of social work training and theories and so on, and find yourself loading up a troopie and taking people out bush. But that's what part of it was.
So I wonder what their expectations were, and whether there's, like you said, a good move would be to go out and visit a community to see if this is actually what you want to do. But how else could we build on social work students' expectations, do you think?
I'm not sure how much is covered in the social work courses to cover living remote. I would say it's not just preparing students, it would be preparing social workers or anyone who's going to work remote, that it's a good idea to go and look at the community first, because there are stories of nurses coming in and being there for half a day and getting the next plane back. They just didn't expect that's what the community would look like.
That was your story, wasn't it? I mean, you had a visit, you had an opportunity to have a visit first before being committed.
That's true, I did.
Yeah. So you've already mentioned a little bit about some of the struggles, and yeah, I was wanting to explore this a little bit more. What do you think were the biggest challenges for you in your role in the community?
It was interesting in that my position did not come with accommodation. So I had to find my own accommodation. And I moved 9 times within those 3 years. And I was there, like I house sat while someone went to hospital. I house sat for teachers when they went on holiday. And I ended up doing some house sharing. It wasn't until the very end that my employer did give me a 1 room with a little ensuite, which made a huge difference because I felt I was settled.
Is that unusual to not have accommodation provided in that setting?
Yes, yeah. It is. But it was something I was prepared to do. And for me, it was also about, well, what actually do I need to live with? I don't need things anymore. I think I learned a lot from being with people in the community because they don't have possessions. They're much more focused on family, on culture, on experiences, rather than collecting things.
Mm.
One of the big challenges as a social worker who I guess came in a bit naively to think that anybody who worked in a remote community or with an Aboriginal community would have some social justice principles. So it was really hard to see every day just to witness racism. That was really hard. And it was also really hard to see some fine young men who 8 years ago had been sniffing or using drugs and they now had mental health issues. Broke my heart a few times. It was really hard to see that. It was also hard because the organisation I worked for used a business model. They weren't a human service organisation, and that was a real conflict between the role of a social worker working in a social emotional wellbeing program, but finding there was all this top-down stuff. And my preferred way of working was bottom-up, alongside, together, two ways, and there was often conflict between what was expected of the program and what actually I felt we were there to do, and what the workers felt they were there to do as well.
So you've mentioned a few challenges for you, the accommodation issues, the ongoing racism. Can you give us a little bit of a picture of what people's experience of racism was like? It's interesting that you say that, given that this is their community, this is their home. It's in a remote part of Australia where what would the percentage of the non-Indigenous population be?
Yeah, maybe about 5%.
So what are people's experience of racism in that context?
There's all these balanders in there. They're the ones with the power. They're the ones with the good salary. They're the ones who distribute Commonwealth funding. And I had a couple of experiences when I was either acting manager or when I acted up. What I was trying to do was to get the community on board and for them to say what they wanted, and also to get the board on board. But it was very difficult having access to the board. And at times when I was able to speak to them, I was encouraged by what they were saying they wanted for their community. But again, the structure of the organisation didn't really let the board members have a say or develop the program the way they were talking to me about.
What effect did it have on you, these struggles that you had? Because you stuck it out for 3 years.
Yes.
So something kept you around. And I'm wondering, what effect did it have on you? And I guess, how did you respond to that? And what is it that sustained you?
I found working with local people was far more worthwhile and exciting than working with other Ballanders. And often Ballanders would be fighting amongst themselves. There'd be jealousy among them. There was this silo approach that we're the best organisation here, we should be the ones doing whatever kind of work it was. What I found worked well is that our program developed strong links with the mental health nurse based in the clinic. He was with Top End Mental Health Services, so we had a good relationship with him and his local worker. And also Team Health had a FAMS program. So the three of us ended up working really well together. And rather than have this silo thing, we were all competing with each other. The three agencies managed to work well together. That made a difference in terms of our clients. We had similar clients and overlapping clients. We would share resources and we would do joint activities. So we maximised the use of people we had, the community workers we had, the resources we had, in order to deliver services for our clients.
And you were also saying that your preference was to work alongside the Aboriginal workers rather than be restricted by this sort of system or organisation that wanted a more professional approach, or they had a particular vision about how the work should happen. Yeah, it sounds like it's about finding this balance, being able to survive within that system, but also have the community on board with you.
And I think that worked through our community workers, that they represented maybe two different clans, maybe three, and that was useful. It would have been good if we could have employed someone from another clan as well. Them keeping us up to date with what was happening in the community, particularly when they gave us background information as to what was going on. And we had one young woman we were working with who was quite frightened, because I'm not quite sure what it was, whether she was promised at birth or... But this man from another community was claiming her, and she didn't want to go with him. She wanted to stay with the partner she had, and his relatives were looking at how that could happen. And mostly, although local workers kept me informed, they knew what to do. They've come across this promised bride thing before. They know what the elders can do. They know how they can stop things happening. But then they also maybe have some obligations. Yes, she was promised at birth, so what do we do in this situation where she doesn't want to go?
So that's a real collaboration too, isn't it? The Aboriginal workers have to have some understandings about Ballinder ways of thinking and the worldview of Ballinder, but also being able to work within their own cultural context as well. What wonderful people to have on that team.
They are amazing, and I think increasingly we became more aware of the needs for them to be able to fulfill their cultural obligations while at the same time being responsible to do their job. And that was always getting the balance right. And it was getting easier to actually write into some of our procedures that I would go out and do some work with community workers, and it would be quite intense, and we'd sort through that the day, and the plan was we'd go back at 9 o'clock in the morning, Ballinder way of thinking. In the meantime, at night, the whole issue came up again. So our two workers were actually working through most of the night. So what we had to do was acknowledge that that was work for them, it wasn't in work time, but they needed time off the next day.
In working through some of the challenges that you've talked about, can you speak a bit more, I guess, about the values or beliefs behind that? Because, yeah, it takes a particular type of person to be able to allow Aboriginal people to step in and give a whole lot of direction about the way the work should go. So what is it that you held in terms of your ethics and values, and what was important for you in allowing that to happen?
My vision was that we would train up our community workers and they would be the ones running the program. So I would have hoped that maybe within 3 years, some of our local workers would become the managers or the co-managers. And really, it should be the community running their own programs. And if we could provide the training for our community workers to be able to step up into that role, then that would be fantastic.
So that's coming back to what you mentioned earlier about self-determination and your idea of the community being really the decision makers and powerhouses behind whatever happens in terms of addressing these social issues in the community.
It's tricky where government funding is so prescriptive, where an organisation's objectives and strategies are so prescriptive, and the community doesn't work like that. That's Ballinder thinking. Whereas to get behind cultural worldview and a family worldview, and to recognise that each different clan would have slightly different worldviews, was part of the challenge.
What role did you play in bringing that view to the table?
It was a hard one, because there's a lot of white people who still think that Aboriginal people need protection. They need to be told what to do. They should become more Western-like. And it's a completely different way of looking at things than the community looks at them, or that I was looking at them. And one of the big things that I realised was, to be effective in the community, you don't just work 9 to 5. People see you in the shop. People see you at weekends. People see you walking home. And for them, that's just another opportunity to talk to you about what's going on in their lives and can you help them.
Can you think of a particular conversation that you might have had in the community with another Ballinder where you were really able to bring this worldview forward, where perhaps they didn't have that perspective or had shown resistance to that?
I wish I could say it happened more often than it actually did. A lot of white people would come to community and they had very fixed ideas about what Aboriginal people were and needed, and their own internal. Sometimes they wouldn't realise they were being racist. It was so ingrained as part of how they had grown up. Mm. And some people, I realise, you don't even try and have a conversation. It's just not going to work.
Mm. Where do these values and principles start for you? Because it's not something that we're born with. They are shaped by our experience growing up in the world and living our lives. Can you trace this commitment that you have to self-determination and really working with communities in ways that empower them, even your commitment to social justice, where that might have begun?
I had an interesting childhood in that I was brought up in Singapore and my parents were quite different. Like, my mother just loved the expat life and the mahjong, coffee mornings, the dinner parties and so on. And my father was quite different. He actually got down and alongside local people and he learned language. He was privileged to learn some of the men's dances. So I grew up with seeing how both worked. Mm-hmm. And I was more taken with what my father showed me because it was just so different.
So you really got an appreciation for what it was like living in one place, but having two very different perspectives about how you operate in that world.
Yes, very much so.
What was it about what your dad was doing that really appealed to you?
It opened up a huge range of ways, of new ways of looking at the world, and gave me a different perspective. And he was interested in different religions and cultures, and I found that fascinating.
Would you say that your dad has been really influential in the work that you're doing today, or are there other people in your life that have been real role models or mentors for you?
I've probably had a sense of wanting to right wrongs from a very early age. I'm not sure where that comes from. And I would often disadvantage myself when I was trying to sort things out that I felt were unjust. So I'm not sure where that came from, but it does seem to have been a part of me as I was growing up. My father was very interested in India, and so I guess we kept up with issues that were happening in India.
How did you come to know or believe or learn about social justice? Is there particular people you'd like to follow or mentors?
Like Mother Teresa, Nelson Mandela, but if I think about what it is about both of them, is that they put other people at the front and they were concerned about other people. And I guess that's what appeals to me, and I guess that's what came out when I went to a remote community.
And this idea of really walking alongside.
Very much, yes. And needing, like, I'm almost embarrassed to say that I went thinking, I'm going to make a difference. And I hear lots of people who talk about going to a new organisation or a new place or to work remote, I want to make a difference. No. The best thing you can do is walk alongside and see where you need to open doors so that other people can do what they need to do. Because often it's the Western white people who set up all these barriers and closed all these doors. And if what we can do is reduce the barriers and open the doors, let people do it themselves.
It's a very common thing, isn't it, when social workers graduate. Oh, I want to go out in the world and make a difference.
It is.
My experience has been often that will lead to burnout. If you think you're going to change the world and you have expectations that are quite high.
There was a nurse that I used to spend a lot of time with, and she was also saying that people come and they want to make a difference and they think they can change the world. And she said to me, what I've learned is you just help one person or one family at a time. And that was a real wake-up call for me, because I'm not going to change the community. I'll do what I can to help them change the community. I can see what the systems are that are preventing them from changing their community. But if I can work with one family at a time and empower and enable them to get more from their lives or to get more from the Western systems, then that'll be great.
Yeah. I have a really strong vision of flying back from the Tiwi Islands every week. And if I can just remember one small thing that I might have done out of the 30 others that I tried to do, if one worked or one was a success story, then that was enough for me to get on that plane and go back out.
Yes.
It's not like we don't have high expectations, but But if we set ourselves too great a vision of being able to change the community, which is not realistic at all, then we're going to be burning out, aren't we?
The great thing is, when going to a remote community, is actually joining in with the culture and living with people, not just go to your own home and your own office and not have any interaction, but actually live with and mix with people. What was inspiring was sometimes at weekends, using somebody's personal troopie, we would go out and collect mud mussels or whatever. And that really meant a lot to local people. We did women's bush trips as well as a group of us going out at weekends. But what I found really demonstrated the importance of culture was taking this group of women out. And I'd seen them around the community and they're walking slowly and they didn't look happy and life is just so hard. Living in a community doesn't work for a lot of Aboriginal people. So we pile into the troopie, we go out to a remote place and then we probably have to walk about half a kilometre or more to where they knew the mangroves were with the best slugs or whatever we were collecting. The change in those women, they all piled into the troopie with bags and cartons and pails. We'd walk across this salt plain and we'd start collecting and they'd teach me how to collect and I just couldn't see. But there's one. I got exhausted after about 2 hours and one of them agreed to walk back to the vehicle with me. And maybe about 2-3 hours later, in the distance, we saw these women coming towards us and they were piled up with bags just full of all their treasures that they put. And they looked so different. They were more alive, they were alert, they were happy, they were chatting. And then we couldn't go back to the community because then they had to heat them up so the shells would crack open and get out the food and just take the food back. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they'd just taken far too much back. And it reminded me of a psychiatrist who said, you going out with, he was talking about some of his male clients or patients, when you check these men out for 2 or 3 hours out bush, that's more than I can achieve in 1 hour of psychiatry with them. So the culture is just so important. And my sense is that a lot of white people don't appreciate that. Why can't they be more like us? Well, no, why can't we be more like them?
Yeah. They have so much to teach us in terms of health and well-being, being out on country.
Yeah. Very much so.
What a great story. If I asked you what is your fondest memory, what comes to mind?
It would be going out bush, and usually because of cultural ways. Occasionally I might go out with a group of men, but with several other male local workers. But it would be going out bush with a group of women and being with them and watching them or taking part. They would go fishing, they would dig, they would light a fire.
I can see your eyes glowing. What was that experience like for you, having them teach you their ways? Because what's really standing out for me as you're sharing that story is that social work in an Aboriginal community, it's not just a job. This is a lifestyle and it's crossing over out of your comfort zone and allowing the community to show you their world. Yeah, what's that really like for you?
It was an incredible experience, a great privilege. My sense is that that wouldn't be available to all social workers. I think the way I approach the whole community aided, like, you need to go slowly, you need to wait to be asked, you need to be vouched for. I don't know who vouched for me. I don't know whether it was a colleague, an Aboriginal colleague. Don't know if it was a client.
Might be several people.
It might have been several people. Mm-hmm. And then slowly people would reveal to me some of their stories. A lot of social workers, well, not just social workers, a lot of people don't want to do that. They don't want to get hot and sweaty and dirty and covered in sand and beating damper that's burnt and got sand over it. And
if that's the case, this is probably not the job for them, hey?
It depends how they see the job. And it depends how much they want to affect change. It depends if you want people to come to you to ask for assistance. I guess that's what worked for me, was just slowly becoming involved with the community.
At their pace.
Yeah.
Just in finishing up, what are you going to take from that experience that you've had out bush into the future? What does the future hold for you?
I'd very much like to be able to use my experience in some way so that other people can be prepared to go and work in a very remote community, can know what some of the challenges are going to be before they get there, perhaps to have some support while they're there, to share some of the things that I found worked well and some of the things that didn't work. I am planning on writing an article, but we'll just see when that unfolds. What I would recommend and what I found worked well for me was that I had an external clinical supervisor. I also had an external supervisor who worked with AMSANT. I had a mentor, an Aboriginal mentor, and I would use my, well, I had four different cultural workers, colleagues, and I would use them to bounce ideas around and get some feedback from.
That sounds like quite a lot of support. Would you say that having all that support has really sustained you in that work for 3 years?
Yes, very much so. It was good to know that every month I could have contact with my clinical supervisor, that my other supervisor was available when I needed to. They both gave me very different, like one was very much a social work supervisor, the other was very much more a cultural, organisational, like how do you work within that organisation to achieve what you want to achieve.
And tell us about this article that you're going to write. What's the flavour of that to be about?
It's still unfolding. I'm very aware that I don't want my 3 years' experience to be lost. Unfortunately, what happened to the Social Emotional Wellbeing Program was that it changed. It reverted back to a medical model using DSM-5 and becoming very clinical focused. It no longer had a cultural focus. It no longer worked with the two other organizations that we were working with. I think that's a huge loss, particularly to that community. There's a huge range, there's a lot of information out there about social emotional wellbeing programs. There's a national social emotional wellbeing that would be good to link into.
I'd love to put some links on the end of this podcast so that people who are interested can follow up on those kinds of topics that you talked about. It's been an absolute delight to hear some of your stories today, Anne. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast to talk about them. And maybe we can follow up with you sometime after this articles written to talk more about your experience.
That would be great.
And just in case people would like to follow up with you about things that you've spoken about, or they're interested in doing some consultation work with you, how might they go about finding you?
I'll give you an email address they can use.
Thank you very much again for coming on the show and sharing your experience, which is so valuable, especially for people that have no idea what it's like to work out in a place like Arnhem Land. It's been an absolute delight, so thank you again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphorically-speaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphorically-speaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.